I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 2nd, 2018. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Senators present tonight, Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilkowski, and myself, Senator Giesel, Senator Coghill is excused today. Thank you to Ann and Kelsey who are helping us out. Today, the committee has three items on the agenda. First, we're going to hear a presentation on the state's managed special areas from the Department of Fish and Game. This was originally scheduled on Wednesday, but we rolled it over to today. Then we'll take up two bills, House Bill 130 and Senate Bill 158. So right now, we will proceed with the hearing, the overview. Special areas are a creation of the legislature. Lawmakers, often at the encouragement of local citizens, and they are a part of Alaska that is unique in terms of habitat, wildlife, and or recreational opportunities. The special management areas refer to state game refuges, game sanctuaries, and critical habitat areas. There's often discussion about access and use of the land. Understanding of how Alaska manages these special areas is critical to building the public's literacy on management policy. So we have Morgan Foss here today. She is a special assistant to the commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. And online, there could be some other folks. Not yet. Okay. So Morgan gets to start. Welcome. I'll let you put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Morgan Foss. I am the Special Assistant to the Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. Our Wildlife Director, Bruce Dale, had to return to Anchorage, but will be joining us online for part of this presentation. So our special areas in Alaska, we have three different types of special areas. We have critical habitat areas, state game refuges, and state game sanctuaries. These are outlined in the Constitution, first of all, as special purpose sites, and they are designated by the legislature for their natural beauty, their historical, cultural, recreational, or scientific value. In statute, we have definitions for all three, for state game refuges, critical habitat areas, and state game sanctuaries. And our management is in turn dictated by statute and the development of our management plans and regulation as well through a collaborative process with the public. And we will describe more about that management plan development process later in the presentation. We have 32 special areas across the state. You will notice that many of them are centralized around Cook Inlet and Bristol Bay to protect waterfowl. Most of these areas were designated in an era prior to GIS and digital mapping satellite imagery. So many of these legal descriptions and cartography descriptions were actually performed by hand.
Morgan, a question. So we have these state-designated areas. How many of those abut or join with federal areas that are similarly designated?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I don't have that figure off the top of my head, but I'm sure that as soon as our Fish and Game staff join us online, they would be able to address that question.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you.
We have 12 wildlife game refuges in the state, 17 critical habitat areas, and 3 wildlife game sanctuaries. These are established for 3 principal reasons: to protect unique or exceptional habitats supporting a broad range of species, including species of conservation and economic concern. Also for the conservation of fish and wildlife populations, if there is a population concern, and for the public use and enjoyment of high-quality environments. They support an array of recreational uses, everything from hunting, fishing, trapping, wildlife viewing, camping, boating, subsistence activities, even commercial activities such as guiding, commercial fishing, livestock grazing, and they have provisions for industrial uses as well, including oil and gas extraction, communications, utilities, material extraction, airports, and harbors. We estimate here at Fish and Game that about, or in excess of rather, 2 million recreational users access these special areas annually, both residents and visitors. And many of them are utilizing local commercial facilities and operations when they do. And our 32 special areas span approximately 3 million acres. That's about 4,600 square miles. And this is about 0.7% of Alaska's total land mass.
Morgan, another question. Tell me the difference between wildlife and game.
You know, through the chair, the definition is somewhat interchangeable. Game is, of course, considered species that might be taken for hunting purposes, and wildlife is a more general term.
Yes, Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Ms. Foss, welcome. Good morning. Good afternoon. Is there one in these refuges and sanctuaries? Can you hunt in either one of them, or one and not the other? Or
through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's a very good question. Those allowances are different for each type of special area. Sanctuaries will be more restrictive on which species can be taken, and even within these categories, there may be differences outlined in statute by the legislature for their uses. And we'll describe those differences later and provide some examples.
Thank you.
Ms. Foss, I also wanted to let you know that Bruce Dale, Ron Benkirk, and Tammy Massey are all now online. Oops, and there's Joe Meehan as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right.
And perhaps one of them would like to address your question from earlier, Madam Chair.
Sure. Thank you for that. So Ms. Foss had suggested perhaps Mr. Dale could answer the question. I wondered how many of the 32 special areas that she's outlined here, it was 32, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Also adjoined to federally managed areas, and is the management similar? So, Mr. Dale, do you have an answer for that?
I would probably have to get back to you, Senator Giesel, to make sure I had it correct, because I'm sure there's a variety of different answers to that based on which area we're talking about. I'm sure some do about federal areas, and then it'll depend on what kind of federal area it is, or whether the regulations for hunting and fishing or access or anything are different.
All right, that'd be great. Mr. Dale, could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm Bruce Dale. I'm the Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation for Fish and Game.
Great. Thank you very much, and thanks for being online. All right, Ms. Foss, you can continue, I think. I don't see any other questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next slide describes the division of labor within our department by our divisions. Our Habitat Division serves as the planning lead and the lead for permitting as well, and they assist with management. They're responsible for developing the management plans for these legislatively designated areas, and we will discuss that process later on in the presentation. Our Wildlife Conservation Division is the co-lead for planning and provides support for permitting, as you see, and for the actual day-to-day operations and management of the refuges and sanctuaries in particular, critical to habitat areas, they will provide the lead in that capacity. But of course, both of those divisions work closely with our sport fish, commercial fisheries, and subsistence divisions as well to defer to their management authorities, and particularly in the development of management plans, we'll collaborate with those entities.
So again, Ms. Foss, you're talking about wildlife conservation. So describe what you mean by that. I mean, is there hunting prohibited in those areas?
Some of the special areas do have restrictions on hunting, and it may be by species. Wildlife conservation is the general term that we use at the Department of Fish and Game for the management of species, in particular game species, but wildlife in general as well.
Okay. All right. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. So how is it determined whether or not what the uses of the management area are, and like who decides whether or not you can hunt there or not hunt there, what species you can hunt? Is that done through a public process, or maybe give a little explanation of how that works?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's an excellent question. The legislature sets in statute the primary purpose for each special area, and then the department will work with the public and user groups and interest groups to interpret that intent. Sometimes the legislature will explain specifically which species are protected, or in other instances it may describe that the intent is to protect the habitat and the species in that habitat, and then the Department of Fish and Game would provide information on which species would be included or covered under that habitat. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Thank you.
All right, I'll let you go on.
Thank you. And we'll definitely provide more information on how those management plans are developed later on, and I think that that will be of great interest to the community.
Great.
So management goals. Our objectives when we manage these legislatively designated special areas are, of course, to meet that statutory responsibility, to maintain and enhance public access. And access is probably the primary consideration as we develop these management plans in accordance to the provisions of the statute. And, of course, we do manage and permit multiple uses. There may be pre-existing commercial or industrial activity or foreseen commercial and industrial activity, and so we find where our habitat and wildlife staff will work to find ways to make that a compatible use with the statutorily designated intent for that special area. In that management plan development process, we also engage local communities, and for each of our divisions, this is part of our primary core mission at Fish and Game, you know, as we do try to manage the resources to best serve the residents of the state of Alaska and visitors, of course, as well. Management plan development. In our management plan development, we do, as I mentioned, engage all public, commercial users, industrial interests, governmental entities, and we try to be as comprehensive as we absolutely can. That serves our purposes because then we won't run into issues later on if we have to end up permitting or addressing concerns that weren't taken into consideration for the development of the management plan. We definitely consider the statutory purpose, and as I mentioned, our primary goal is to protect public access to those resources while maintaining that statutory intent. One thing that I would like to mention, too, is that when we do develop these management plans, the Board of Fish and the Boards of Game do maintain their allocative authority. Mm-hmm. So within these refuges and sanctuaries and critical habitat areas, the Boards of Game, of course, will work within the bounds of statute, but they maintain the allocative authority for the resource. We do not take that over as a department. We do issue permits to try to align user activity with the uses that are outlined in the management plan. Over the past 5 years, we've received almost 700 applications for use permits. Roughly 23 of those were determined to not require a permit. In 9 instances, applications were withdrawn. And it seems as though there are roughly 2 or 3 instances where permits were denied. We even encountered one instance where staff initially denied a permit, and then the commissioner turned it over and issued the permit. I think that was for the construction of a tree stand. And we can provide more information on those particular permits and why they were denied. In most cases, it will be there was an incompatible use with the intent of statute or with other user groups or to a species within that habitat.
Senator Wilikowski.
Just want to make sure I get those numbers. So, how many permits were applied for, and how many were denied?
In the past 5 years, users applied for 693 permits, and it seems that 3 were likely denied.
We'll follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, and if you just maybe could get us what's publicly available, just maybe a synopsis or something on the 3 that were denied. I'd be curious to see that, Madam Chair.
So, Ms. Foss, in the management plans, you must, I don't know this, but do you designate what use that area will get, or like, is it going to be used for hunting or fishing? I mean, how specific are those management plans?
Through the chair, and I apologize for not mentioning that earlier, I would like to take this opportunity to have Ron Benkart, who is our fish and game coordinator, explain more about that process. He oversees that planning process, and I believe that he will be much more articulate than
all
I.
All right. All right. Mr. Benkirk?
Yes, so Ron Benkirk, fish and game coordinator for the Habitat Division out of Anchorage. Basically, the birds of fish and the birds of game still retain their ability to set hunting regulations within special areas. In fact, a lot of times, hunting is encouraged in a lot of the special areas. You know, we obviously encourage hunting in Palmer Hay Flats and Sixty Flats. That's one of the primary objectives of the management plan, is to provide public access for not only hunting, but fishing, recreational activities of wildlife viewing, what have you. So the actual setting of regulations for the taking of game is a task that was for the game, not for the Habitat Division or the management planning process.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. I'll let you go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would mention, too, that in that management plan development process, we do have a public comment period, and the public will often provide feedback after a management plan has even been established, and some management plans are updated frequently. I've seen instances of a management plan being adapted every 2 years based on new developments in user interests and activities within that area. Management issues. Our Department of Wildlife State Game Refuge Manager Joe Meehan, who is also online, is one of the primary individuals responsible for management issues that come up within our special areas. These activities may include maintaining trail access and upgrades, boundary marking, providing mapping and marking trails for users, and updating website information for user access. Facility upkeep also is one of our focuses, and that pertains to vandalism, waste disposal. We do end up mitigating impacts of users, which can include, you know, dumping. I know that the National Guard has provided a considerable amount of volunteer time in assisting with cleaning up items that were dumped in refuges, for example, old vehicles, large home appliances. Items like that, and they can accumulate, and they impact users' ability to access and enjoy the area. So we, at the department, we certainly appreciated the donated time to assist with those. And, of course, we do permit and lease activity monitoring. We do field inspections and basic resource monitoring to ensure that user activity is indeed compatible with the statutory intent. These are some examples of special area use and activities. All of these are not consistent for each and every special area, but these are examples of some of the activities that do occur. Multiple use mandates will describe primary purposes within each management plan, and there are a wide variety of recreational and subsistence and commercial activities as we've described. They're different by each special area. Some of our special areas are much more remote and see much less user access than others. And later on in this presentation, or actually on our next slide here, rather, we'll get into four examples of special areas that we selected. We wanted to cover a sanctuary, a critical habitat area, and a refuge, at least, to demonstrate how they might be different in statute, and even within those categories, there can be differences in those uses. And for this segment, I will turn the floor over to our director, Bruce Dale, to describe the McNeil River State Game Refuge and Sanctuary.
Great. Director Dale, you're on.
Thank you, Bruce Dale from the Department of Fish and Game.
The first one we'd like to show and present to you is the McNeil River State Game Refuge and Sanctuary. This is a actually world-famous resource that the state of Alaska is very proud of. It was established in 1967 by the legislature. The refuge area around the sanctuary was added in 1993. And the big attraction there, of course, is the magnificent brown bears that are attracted to the abundant salmon. And we have lots and lots of folks from all over the world come to photograph and view bears there. So it is one of the ones that that the legislature specifically excluded hunting with bears there because it was such a special resource. The next one is the Palmer Hay Flats State Game Refuge. This was established in 1975, and it's used for a lot of things. It's closed into, you know, population centers and anchors in the Mattsu Valley. One of the big attractions is it's a big staging area for waterfowl that are migrating through. It's not a big nesting area so much, but it does attract a lot of waterfowl of all kinds. And it is very popular for hunting. In addition, it has a full suite of fur bears, and there's good salmon fishing, too, on the refuge. A lot of people will also, birders frequently use that area, and it's quite popular.
Director Dale, before you leave that, it is, of course, really close to transportation corridor and all of that. Do you see a lot of user conflicts?
I don't think so. I can't think of any that really stand out. There's boaters and there's hikers and people that get around in different ways and canoes and kayaks, as well as some RV use. But for the most part, they seem to be pretty coexisting. Because the area is kind of close to a lot of folks, we do have some issues with people dumping garbage and other things. But it's supported by a user group that is really helpful and works along with the state to make sure it's kept clean and provide the kind of facilities and access that the public wants.
Thank you.
Okay, so the next one is the Flat State Game Refuge. And this is an interesting area. It was established in 1976. A lot of these special areas were established about the same time. It is a big nesting area for waterfowl, feeding and also staging areas during migration. It's good moose habitat, popular for moose hunting. And there's some good winter habitat there. Also because of the salmon resources, there's bear hunting and bear viewing in this area. And of course the fishing is good too. And there's important, rearing and spawning habitats within this refuge. It's notable because you have oil and gas industry just offshore from the inlet there. But it's a lot of people fly over for waterfowl hunting, and that's one of the main uses besides fishing.
Senator Bishop had a question. Excuse me, Director Dale. Senator Bishop had a question.
Mr. Dale, do you allow for duck camps over there in that refuge?
Yes, there are. There are duck camps, often referred to them as shacks or cabins. Camping is, like in many wetland areas, camping sites are at a premium. So it makes it much more user-friendly to have those.
Thank you.
There currently are some cabins that, you know, I think they're leased for the life of the permittee, and then what to do with them after that time ends has been something the department has been struggling with, trying to figure out a way, a cost-effective way to make them still available for users.
Great. Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff also has a question. Director Dale.
Thank you, Director Dale. I think you just hit the nail on the head. I do know several constituents of mine that have actually talked about the duck shacks that are in that area, and that they're well aware that with the end of their life, the shacks, no one knows what's going to happen to those shacks. And they're wondering if, you know, next generation, if they can sell them, sell the rights to a friend or to a family member. There has been discussion about that issue that you just brought up.
Yes, thank you. There's a model that I recently learned about that we haven't looked at, and it's to see how it's managed, and it may be appropriate, but there's a program in Southeast where the Territorial Sportsman's Organization makes an arrangement and builds cabins on state lands, and then they're managed by, I think, state parks. But we'll look into that, too, because this is an issue that we need to deal with.
Any follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff? All right. Great. I think we're on slide 14.
Yeah, the last area is the Fox River Flats critical habitat area in Kachemak Bay, the mouth of the Fox River. It was established in 1972. It's an important area for migratory shorebirds, waterfowl, other water birds, moose, and other terrestrial animals. It's kind of that rich zone where the river meets a bay, and the legislature chose to designate that as a critical habitat area. And that concludes my presentation.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions from committee members for Mr. Dale, Ms. Voss? Thank you. I appreciate the presentation. And now the committee will therefore move on to the second agenda item, which has to do with Department of Fish and Game, and that's House Bill 130. So House Bill 130 aims to correct errors that were made in documenting the parcels of land that are within various state-managed special areas. These errors, often 40 to 50 years old, result in some parcels within the special management areas being excluded, contrary to the intent of the law creating these game refuges, sanctuaries, and critical habitat areas. So House Bill 130 was introduced in February of last year. It passed the other body in April of last year, and it came to the Senate and this committee at the end of the 2017 regular session. So I will let Ms. Voss present House Bill 130 to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a subject with which I am somewhat more familiar. So this legislation is something that the department has considered for some time, as many of these boundary description errors in statute have existed since the inception of those areas. Some of these errors have existed since the mapping was done as early as 1913. And as we walk through the maps that will be impacted by this legislation, we will describe which were transcription errors, how these errors came to be. As I mentioned earlier, each special area is defined in statute, and so those boundary descriptions may be by township or based on maps that were drawn up by the USGS in the 60s and 70s. This first one that we have on the screen here, the Eisenbeck State Game Refuge, you will notice that there are sections on the map, and I should start by saying that this is on the Alaska Peninsula near Cold Bay, and this was established by the legislature in 1972. This lagoon area includes tidal and submerged land, and This is delineated by the mean high water line on shore. In these red areas, you will see that these sections were not included in statute as containing mean high water line, and that's why we would like to add them in to meet the statutory intent. These omissions were likely due to errors in the USGS maps or lack of information when these were established. The intent of the statute is to incorporate these water bodies within the National Wildlife Refuge watershed, and adding the entire water body fully protects the waterfowl and shorebird habitat of the bay and the lagoon. And unless there are any questions on this slide.
Let me just ask a quick question. So these red areas were excluded. They don't have, they haven't been claimed as private property or anything like that.
Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, no, I do not believe that there is private property on any of those areas. And if I am incorrect, then I hope that one of my colleagues will correct me. But no.
Senator Bishop also has a question.
To follow along, dovetail on Senator Chair Giesel's comments, these changes will have to be advertised in the public record, right? When this have these surveys been advertised? Are they part of the public record? I mean, are they recorded in newspapers? Where I'm going is, let's just say hypothetically there was a private property owner there and he could read in the paper, well, these are the same lat and longs as my property here, so we've got an issue. So do we do that when this bill is passed, or is it done before? You must have done it before, or you wouldn't have brought it to us in this form.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we have performed surveys on certain areas that are included within these boundary refuges. There are others that, upon inclusion, we will do additional survey work. A large part of our work is outreach to the public, and so if this were to pass the legislature, we would certainly reach out to affected users within each of these refuges to inform them of the changes that might be impacted. And in many instances, because we are following the intent of the statute to the best of our ability, there will not be significant impacts to users by cleaning up the statutory language.
Thank you. I'll let you proceed, Ms. Foss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next slide describes Cape Newenham State Game Refuge, and this is a similar situation to Eisenbeck. It was also established in 1972 and includes tidal and submerged land. And again, we have a segment of Chagavan Bay that was not described in its entirety in statute. And so this would be a cleanup to describe where that mean high water line is, and we would conduct surveys to describe that in our management plan as well. This particular state game refuge, Palmer Hay Flats, may be more familiar to the legislators present, as it is in a more central location in the Knick Arm. It was designated in 1975, and contains watersheds fed from the Matanuska and the Knick River. The affected areas here relate to riverbeds. These riverbeds are owned by the public in the state. Currently, there is motorized boat access on these waterways, and so incorporating them into our authority would not impact users from bringing boats up into these areas. We also have general permits for winter overland travel, so ATV access over frozen waterways. These are, in almost all cases, anadromous streams, and so they support salmon spawning and rearing activity, and that is why we would like to include them in the intent, meeting the intent of statute. These plats were surveyed in 1913 with a fixed river channel description, And since that time, of course, these waterways have shifted and now meander in and out of that fixed plat description. So this is a cleanup and allows us to then apply our management plan to those areas that were previously excluded as platted river, now that we have determined that there is anadromous activity in these areas. The Port Moeller Critical Habitat Area boundary, this description was erroneously transcribed. And as you can see, it was shifted. And one of the most negative effects of this error was that the community of Nelson Lagoon was then placed within a critical habitat area. It was designated in 1972, and the legal description referenced USGS topographical maps from the 1960s in which the labels were actually misprinted across, there was a range shift that occurred in the northern portion of the area. So the statutory description then causes the CHAs to be shifted 6 miles west of where it was intended to be. And it was specifically intended to exclude the community of Nelson Lagoon. Since then, the department, knowing that this was due to an error, has not pursued any habitat permitting for the community, as this we understand this not to be the intent, but it would be a benefit to the department and to the community to have this description cleaned up in statute. Again, in the EGIC critical habitat area, this boundary was affected by two typos that occurred in the original legislation from 1972. In both instances, one character in the description was replaced instead of, you know, one instead of two, or north instead of south, and so these blocks were shifted, and instead there's a non-contiguous block that is affected, and we'll see this on the next slide for Pilot Point as well. Only state lands are affected by this, and the locations are not near any infrastructure or villages. You can see this same instance occurring in Pilot Point here as well. The Fox River Flats Critical Habitat Area was created in 1972 as well. It is located in Kachemak Bay and partially overlaps with the Kachemak Bay Critical Habitat Area. Along the north and east boundaries, four of the seven sections have tide and submerged lands excluded. And I can provide additional information on what a section is for mapping purposes if the committee would like. I also brought handouts from the Department of Natural Resources for the committee, and we can share those on BASIS later, but I did bring enough for the committee members if that would help. We often describe these in terms of sections or townships. In Kachemak Bay, we'll see how we use lists of townships to describe the affected areas. But in these sections, these blocks that we see on the map, the exclusion was not applied consistently across either the upland or the tideland areas. And we would remove the exclusion from the four sections containing blue crosshatching on this lower map, for consistency within the CHA, in the critical habitat area. So the purple line that we see on the map is the mean high water line, which divides the uplands from the tidelands in the submerged area. And the only land added within the boundary to that CHA is areas where the purple line, the mean high water, intersects with the blue hatched area. At this time, that includes Bradley River on the east side as well. One thing to note with Fox River Flats is that this bay has both seen sinking and the land is rebounding as well. And so this impacts where these channels, where these purple lines will intersect with tidal land. And these channels do contain, in particular, coho rearing habitat. And so we want to consistently apply our management plan across those areas. Here we see the Kachemak Bay Critical Habitat Area. This boundary description error resulted from one particular township being omitted from the list that was submitted to create this It was simply an oversight. Kachemak Bay was established in 1974, and it was described within a list of townships and ranges, and only the tide and submerged land and waters within those townships and ranges. So this affected area, I should note, will actually increase the boundary of this critical habitat area because it will shift it up against the tide line. And I don't think I've clearly described that in previous presentations, and so I wanted to make sure that on the record we do realize that this will add, we're estimating around 200 acres without having surveyed it, by shifting this boundary up against the tideland here. It will not impact the actual property owners there, but it will make the critical habitat area abut up against that. So the excluded area, if you're familiar with this critical habitat area or Kachemak Bay, it lies seaward of the base of the Switchback Trail, which is well above the mean high water and would not be impacted for user access. And the beachfront in front of Kachemak Salo, which is along the Fox River Flats Trail and is already part of the critical habitat area below mean high water. And longstanding access to these areas would not be affected. Finally, our one actual intended addition to critical habitat area, or special area in general, is Dude Creek. The Dude Creek's critical habitat area itself was created in 1988. It is situated adjacent to the city of Gustavus near Glacier Bay here in southeast Alaska. The proposed addition was purchased by the Nature Conservancy in 2004 and transferred to the state for management, and the intended purpose was to be included with the Dude Creek critical habitat area. Right now, the Department of Natural Resources is the custodian, and in order to incorporate this into the critical habitat area, as the community has asked us to do, we would need to include its description and statute and then develop a management plan. And in November of 2016, the city of Gustavus passed a resolution urging us to make these changes so that they could collaborate with the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of DNR in developing that management plan. The significance of this area is that it's a stopover for migratory sandhill cranes and other migratory birds. Motorized vehicle use is still allowed in this area, and as is hunting and trapping and user access across Icy Strait, across the frontier of Icy Strait, would not be impacted. And we do have language in the bill that the management plan should preserve access to non-critical habitat area lands, so to private lands, to a school trust parcel, and a native allotment. And I believe that is the conclusion of materials we have to cover here, and we would be more than happy to answer any questions. I will add that this is approximately, here in Dude Creek, approximately 1,400 acres that would be added.
Right. Any questions for Ms. Foss? All right. Seeing none. Thank you. So I would like to open public testimony on House Bill 130. And I'm looking here, and we've got some folks online, it looks like, interested in testifying. So I'm going to start out at the Anchorage LIO. I see Wayne Hall is online there. So Anchorage LIO, if you could open up the lines. We'll hear from Mr. Hall first and then Marilyn Hauser. Mr. Hall, can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, quite clearly. So if you would identify yourself for the record and your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Wayne Hall. I'm a resident of Anchorage and of Alaska for the past 40 years. I'm representing myself here. I just wanted to say I am a big supporter of the special areas in Alaska, and I certainly support these boundary changes and additions. Special areas and habitat, fish, and wildlife protections they provide are really important to me and for their benefits to the fish and wildlife itself. I strongly support the additions of the Dew Creek area as generously provided for by the Nature Conservancy, and I'm hoping this is the extent of this bill, and that it can just move on through as it was passed by the House. That's all I have for right now.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. In addition, I'll just let all the folks know online, if you would like to additionally send your comments in writing, we would be happy to accept them, and they would be attached to the bill file as it moves along. So next in at the Anchorage LIO is Marilyn Hauser, and after we finish with Marilyn, we'll move to the Homer LIO. Ms. Hauser, welcome.
Hi, my name is Marilyn Hauser. I live in Anchorage. I have been in Alaska, a resident of Alaska, for almost 40 years, and I am representing myself. I support HB 130 that would add approximately 1,400 acres to the refuge and critical habitat area boundaries. In this time, it's extremely important to preserve habitat, and I wish to see these areas managed for the preservation and protection of fish and wildlife habitat. That's really all I have at this point, and I hope this bill moves forward as it was originally intended, just to do these housekeeping things. And the good news is, add a couple hundred more acres to these areas. Protected. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So moving to the Homer LIO, we'll hear from Robert Archibald first, followed by Nicole Arvalo. Robert, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senate Resource Committee. My name is Robert Archibald, and I'm representing Friends of Ketchikan Bay State Park and also the Ketchikan Bay Water Trail. As you well know, Ketchikan Bay is a critical habitat, and it is impacted and by its users. We certainly would like to see this bill pass. The management plan for the critical habitat is being updated at this time, and for both Ketchikan Bay and Fox River Flats, it would be beneficial for the management of these areas that this coincides with this new management plans. So we certainly advocate for this to move forward, and hope that you see that also. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Archibald. So Nicole Arvalo is there at the Homer LIO. We'll hear from her, and then we're going to go to the off-net and hear from Tom Roth. Nicole, welcome.
Hello, members of the Senate. My name is Nicole Arvalo, resident of Homer, and I'm representing myself. I'm speaking in support of HB 130. This bill merely seeks to address a few minor details in the current boundary lines for certain protected habitat areas. I kind of see it as a bit like re-editing the grammar on the second draft of an essay. Since the 1970s, Fish and Game has had time to manage these areas, and mapping has improved, and with experience, there have been a few mistakes in the boundary distinctions caught over the years, so now is a good time to correct them. Looking at this bill, I was reading that Fish and Game has determined there are no additional financial costs associated with these proposed changes, and in fact, by streamlining management, these minor alterations will save them time, so that's good. There will be no net change in acreage for Igigig, Pilot Point, or Port Muller habitat protections. The areas protected targeted in this bill that do change acreage only receive a small increase in size, and the reason for that is to make more sensible, concise legal boundaries. Some lands that make it into the original boundary lines are not right for habitat protections and would be freed up, including that Nelson Lagoon story that we just heard from the presenter. The wetlands abutting the Dude Creek critical habitat area have already been purchased and donated to the state for the express purpose of being included in that management area in cooperation with the Department of Natural Resources. And they've been being managed by Fish and Game similarly to the rest of the critical habitat area, and their official inclusion into that boundary is simply the final step in the legal process that state agencies have been following. So it's a common sense bill that cleans up and clarifies the boundary descriptions, keeping in line with the intention of lawmakers who originally delineated these areas, and makes it easier for managers to do their work and for others to get a firm sense of where the boundaries are. So making life easier for Fish and Game and having more sensible boundaries for these management zones gets a thumbs up from me. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Nicole. You must be a teacher if you view this as the correction on an essay.
I am not.
Okay. Thank you. So now we'll go to the off-net. We'll hear from Tom Roth first, and then we'll go to George Pierce. Mr. Roth, welcome. Be sure to unmute your phone.
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Now we can hear you. Welcome, Tom.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate you and the committee offering this opportunity to comment. Tom Rothy, testifying as a citizen of Eagle River, 40-year-plus resident, hunter, fisher, conservationist, and I appreciate our ability to use public lands for our enjoyment. I also am a retired fish and game waterfowl biologist, was for 25 years, and so I'm very familiar with the special areas and resources that occur on those lands. I'll just hit a couple of points. One is the state public lands are increasingly important because our access in other parts of the state, actually even in Alaska, are becoming limited, and to have wildlife refuges and critical habitats to hunt in and camp on are very important for a lot of people, especially around urban areas. Secondly, I'd like to really emphasize that over the years, Fish and Game has done a very competent and transparent job of management planning for every one of these areas, dealing with some really thorny issues on a couple of them, including like Palmer Hay Flats and several others. And they're very thorough, and I think these management plans represent the best solutions to issues, bearing in mind all the values of these areas. And thirdly, I'd like to just point out that the management of state game refuges, in particular in critical habitats, is substantially different than what we're aware of with the national wildlife refuges and federal conservation units. I think we all agree that the best sensible regulation comes from closest to home, where people live and use the resources. So in this way, I think state government and Fish and Game DNR have done a really good job that provides the citizens probably a lot more latitude and input in figuring out how these diverse uses will be delineated. Other people have mentioned the key aspects of this bill, so I won't go into it, other than I think it should be pretty embarrassing to state government to not correct boundary lines for 40 years. None of us would want the government to come in and pencil a property line in over our lands, and then it's unknown whether you have to comply or not. So I'll leave that to the lawyers to determine the impacts of ownership, but I don't think ownership itself is the point here. I think it's just correcting mistakes. And particularly an appointed example where Nelson Lagoon got accidentally included in a loop that maybe they weren't aware of. So other than that, I think others have pointed out the benefits of private entities coming in and adding lands to our public hunting and fishing areas, and I think that's absolutely great. So I'll leave it with one more point, and that is to emphasize that none of the actions in this bill will substantially change a management plan. It will not increase restrictions. It will not call for policy changes that affect how people use these areas. It simply changes the boundaries and the existing management plans, which I think are generally very good, would apply to the new areas. So I'm confident this is a great bill, and urge you to please pass it to the floor.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, Tom. So now we'll go to George Pierce in Kasilov. Mr. Pierce.
Yes, this is George Pierce calling from Kasilov. I think this is a terrible idea. I'm against this idea. And if it was for emergencies only, that would be one thing. But now it seems everyone is coming to drive on the new road. Once everybody starts driving on this new road, there goes the wildlife, and it won't come back. It's not worth it, in my opinion. It is a critical habitat area for a reason, and should stay that way. Protect fish and wildlife. Thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Pierce, for your testimony. So that completes the people online. Is there anyone else online wishing to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone here in the room in Juneau wishing to testify? Seeing none, I close public testimony on House Bill 130. So, committee members, any other questions right now for ADF&G? All right, seeing none, we'll set the bill aside for now. Thank you very much, Ms. Foss, and to all the ADF&G employees that were online to help us with the bill. We appreciate it. So now going on to the final item for today's hearing. This is Senate Bill 158. When homeowners discover an oil spill on their property, usually a heating oil tank that spills, the Department of Environmental Conservation has the authority tasked with managing that spill. The law as it now stands requires the department to pass its cleanup costs to the homeowner without exceptions. This discourages property owners from reporting the spills. The bill before us aims to make it easier for homeowners to come forward, spills to be identified and cleaned up, and the department to reward those who promptly report a spill. So I welcome from the Department of Environmental Conservation, Kristen Ryan, who is the head of the Spill Prevention and Response Division, to present the bill. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, State of Alaska. I don't have a prepared presentation today. I'm hoping you guys will have questions for me that can help me further explain the purposes and intent of the legislation. I will give a brief overview. We respond to spills of all sizes in the state of Alaska, homeowners included. We respond to about 2,000 spills a year on average, and I would roughly say about 60 of those are from homes that have a home heating oil tank release. We have found that homeowners are struggling to deal with this situation. They are unequipped, usually financially, and usually don't have the technical expertise to know what to do. We find insurance companies rarely are willing to cover the costs of addressing the problem, so the financial impact can be substantial. They are very highly variable in what they cost to address a home heating oil tank release, but some examples that we're aware of are $6,000 for a minor leak of a couple gallons to $80,000 when an entire tank has been released and perhaps contaminated property nearby. So it can run the gamut. And usually homeowners are stuck in that situation with having to address that problem. And it's a huge hardship. We have found that it inhibits people to contact us knowing that we're going to hold them accountable for addressing this release. Now, they're required by law to call us, of course, but we want to help them. I mean, our goal is to help them address their problem and reduce the environmental contamination and perhaps public health issues associated with having fumes in their home. We can provide that technical service right now, but we have to bill them for it. So this legislation would allow us to waive our cost recovery requirements by statute and provide technical assistance to homeowners as they try to grapple with this problem that they don't have the expertise to deal with in those situations. So we have found over the years it's just a real hardship. It's hard on my staff. They struggle. They try to hide the fact that they're helping homeowners because they don't want a bill to be generated by their time. It's just not a good situation. and we all have the same goal of wanting to solve this problem. The revenue generated by cost recovery from these situations is rather minimal. We feel it's not worth the cost of homeowners not contacting us to address their problem. Primarily, this is an issue in Fairbanks and Juneau, where home heating oil is more commonly used. At Anchorage, we don't see much of it. And rural Alaska as well, of course. So that, I guess, is the basics of it. I would go over quickly the steps of cleaning up a home heating oil tank. We break it into three areas. Source control, you need to stop the leak at all possible. Then you need to recover free product so that it doesn't seep into the ground, if possible. And then, of course, the contaminated soil removal. Those are the three steps that my staff spend a lot of time working with homeowners to figure out what the source is, to stop the source. Often they don't know about it until they realize they're out of fuel and they just got their tank filled. So, you know, it can be a big release because that's the trigger point for an underground storage tank. You don't realize it's empty until it's empty. And it shouldn't have been empty. So not only is there the cost of dealing with the contamination, they've also just lost a lot of fuel that they just bought. That can be a pretty big hardship. If it's the time of year like this, they have to come in, they have to get a storage tank brought in with extra fuel so they can keep their house warm while they address this problem. And it can be overwhelming. And we hear it over and over again of the cases of individuals that are overwhelmed and then they get a bill from us, from calling us. And it just seems to add insult to injury when we feel like our job is to try to help them solve their problem. And we'd like to do that without sending them a bill. We tried to propose standards that would limit who would be getting this this tree service from us, so that it only is the small people that don't generate much revenue for us anyway. So our efforts of cost recovery are really a worthless. They're not helpful even to generate revenue, and they cost us efforts to try to track them down and get the money out of them. And so the revenue generated isn't worth the time that's taking us to achieve it, and it has this consequence of inhibiting compliance. That's all I would say. Any questions?
Well, thank you. I wondered, it's a two-page bill,
yeah.
And the content is actually in Section 3, and there are, it's Section E as in echo, and there are 4 points there. I wondered if you could just talk us through the criteria. It appears that this is a list of criteria, and if you could just talk us through what they are, the rationale, help us understand the implication.
Yes, Madam Chairman. We spent quite a bit of time thinking about how we could craft this in a way to capture the people we were most wanting to help. We are interested in homes, as I've mentioned, single-family homes. We recognize that duplexes are units also that are very common in Alaska. We decided 4 units or less was probably still considered reasonably small. Somebody owning a housing complex bigger than that hopefully would have either, you know, better financial resources available to them to address the problem. It becomes more of a commercial operation at that point, was our thinking. We're interested, obviously, in just a leak from home heating oil, not some commercial operation. So that's why we restrict it to the piping and tankage and equipment used to generate power for the home. This isn't, you know, your commercial operation of storing fuel and then selling it to others. We want it used at the home for power generation. We want the homeowners to do what they can to address the problem. And prevent it with prevention and reporting to us as quickly as possible. The sooner we can respond, the better the outcome will be. It's critical for us that they don't wait 3 months and then call. You know, we want there to be some incentive for them to call us immediately so we can get on it faster. We want them to take measures to contain it if possible. If it's a leak, put a bucket under it. I mean, there's got to be things they can do to minimize the damage. And that they cooperate with us and provide access to the property. And I mean, right now we are told no sometimes. We aren't allowed on the property because they don't want the bill. It's a really awkward situation. We don't want to go to court to demand access, but they have an issue that needs follow-up. So I mean, they need to obviously be cooperative and let us have access to the property. So that was our reasoning for the criteria as posed in the legislation.
Very good. Thank you. Question, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. So just kind of a few technical questions on how this would work. Looking at page 2, line 6, it says it's available for people with single-family homes or residential buildings. Would that apply to trailers? I have a lot of trailers in my district, for example. This happens all the time, as you know.
That's true. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, yes, a single-family home or residential building is not restricted to, you know, mortar and bricks. It'd be a trailer, would be considered a home.
Okay. Then a couple other questions. Mm-hmm. So it says, page 2, line 2, the department may waive all or a portion of the response cost. Is it just totally discretionary? Could the department do two houses right next to each other and say, well, we want to pay this one and we don't want to pay this one?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, our process for cost recovery is automated through a billing system. It's all through timekeeping. So time tracking manages all staff's time, and they have to charge their time to certain codes. So it would be an automated process, is my point. That wouldn't be discretion to, other than, you know, they would have to make sure it meets the criteria outlined in the statute. But other than that, it's going to be automated, that the cost recovery option would be turned off in situations that meet this criteria.
So follow up. Is there a reason that we would say department may waive all or portion? Is there a reason you don't have shall? And then also, same question with all or a portion. How would you decide, well, for this homeowner we're going to pay 50%, for this one we're going to pay nothing, for this one we're going to pay 100%? How does that work?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the mayor shall, I think we just wanted to have some flexibility for unforeseen situations. I really have no opinion as to why it should be mayor shall. It wasn't really contemplated. The other aspect, though, that you were commenting on, I would prefer to keep the flexibility in there, because the way this is written, it's focused on our cost recovery, right? Our recovering our costs to provide technical assistance. There is a capital appropriation, though, in the budget this year that would allow us to also provide some financial resources to homeowners that meet hardship criteria. They've got a spill. They have a release. They're on Social Security. They have three kids. You know, there's all this criteria they have to meet through hardship standards that are already in regulation. That we may decide, if the capital appropriation is granted, to provide some financial assistance for the actual cleanup itself. That's why we need some flexibility. So the things that we may be able to provide some relief for will be variable depending on, you know, maybe one home we just want to provide the ability for them to monitor vapors because they're going up into the child's room, and in some homes we may decide it needs to be more extreme measures. So we need some flexibility in each situation as to what can be waived.
Follow up?
So two questions, I guess. Should this be needs-based? You mentioned that someone is a millionaire, they can afford it, versus someone who has no money at all. So that's one question. And then the other question is, should there be requirements that the homeowner go through, at least try to go through their homeowner's insurance policy, or perhaps file a negligence case against maybe the prior owner or something like that? Should there be some sort of requirements to do either of those things?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So I think the way it's written, it inherently captures needs-based. I mean, we're trying to keep this at somebody, it's their home heating fuel. It's a single-family home up to four residents. I mean, we're only looking to provide this relief for small homeowners and not commercial operators. So I think that's sort of captured. Remind me what your other question was.
Negligence. Should there be a requirement to file a like a lawsuit against a prior owner, for example?
Senator Wilokowski, I mean, that is, I think, there's going to be a lot of costs associated with these events, and I would anticipate any homeowner would be doing that anyway to if they were not the responsible party for the release. Like I mentioned already, the cost, $6,000 was probably is the low end of what this costs. So if you're a homeowner and you've purchased a property, a lot of these things actually are discovered during sales transactions. And that's when previous owners who may have been the cause can be pursued through court mechanisms. I mean, we aren't, this in no way is inhibiting a homeowner's ability to go after damages through the court process if they feel that they weren't the cause of the release. I also would mention on for homeowners insurance, we have found that no homeowners insurances will cover the costs associated with this, unless the only situations we've seen some assistance provided if the contamination leaves their property and impacts other people's property. At that point, sometimes we have found some insurances are willing to help. But if it's on their property, it's very rare that an insurance company will agree to provide any assistance.
Follow up.
Just looking at number 2 on line 8 through 10, page 2, it says that you have to make a written finding that the person did not willfully or negligently fail to comply with spill prevention. But I suppose you could envision scenarios where somebody says, well, I've got a spill. I'm going to transfer it to you, sell my property to you for a dollar, and then have the state pick up the costs. Because then, technically, the person who owns the property did not willfully or negligently fail to comply. It's the person before them. Is that contemplated?
Senator Wilokowski, that is reminding me of our other bill, Senate Bill 64, which is Uniform Environmental Governance Act, to avoid that, so that there's full disclosure when contaminated property is transferred, because that, obviously, if you're purchasing property, you should be fully disclosed that what you're getting is contaminated. Again, we'd defer to the courts. If there's those actions are occurring and a purchaser received property that's contaminated and they didn't know it, they would be pursuing that individual through the judicial system.
Senator Von Imhoff has a question, and she'll be followed by Senator Meyer.
Thank you very much. So I appreciate Senator Wilokowski's initial questioning. I had the exact same questions. I'm hoping to read this bill that, assuming that the home qualifies under the criteria, that everyone will automatically be granted the waiver initially, at least to a certain threshold amount. I think that seems fair, and that's sort of how I see the bill being written at this point. Is that correct?
Senator Von Imhoff, yes. I mean, just for ease of operation, I mean, as I said, it's a manual system, automated system, and so they're just billing will stop automatically. It will be seamless. My staff won't even know what when bills are going on and when they're not.
Okay.
Once they hit the criteria button that this meets us, it's done, and it'll be applied. I think we would only go back and try to, if one of these criteria were not met, that would be the situation where we'd be like, gosh, that homeowner's not letting us on the property. Maybe it's, this is complicated. We need to go revisit that.
Okay.
Follow up.
Thank you. I see that the this bill is retroactive to 1/1/18. So I also saw that in the Department of Environmental Conservation, there was a flyer or information document. It says there's currently, let's see what it said here. We have, in 2017, 50 of these types of spills happened, but there's currently 150 active sites that would be eligible. So are we retroactively going back to 1/1/18, or are we going back earlier? I mean, did all these sites become eligible in the last couple weeks, or are these ongoing sites for the last couple years?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, they've been ongoing. It's these sites take usually quite a long time to resolve. So no, there are sites that happened several years ago that we're not going to go back and reimburse them.
Okay, you're not going to go back and reimburse them,
right.
But starting from now, they will not be charged.
Correct.
Okay. All right. And then I have one last question.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. And then it says that in the fiscal note, it says that the regs will not be written until 2020. Why so long from now?
Senator Von Eichhoff, the chair, they'll be written as soon as the bill becomes law, if it becomes law. I think we just put that in there as a window of so we had some time to get it done. I won't take that long.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. It actually says regulations will be adopted by 2020.
It says adopted.
So it does take time to write them, and then, of course, they go out for public comment, and then they come back.
Right. We just were trying to leave room for the process. I will do them as soon as we can. We're very interested in setting this up.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. If I recall, your budget, your operating budget is pretty small. Can you absorb this $60,000 reduction in revenue?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, the way our budget works is the revenue collected through cost recovery goes into the fund, and the legislature allocates a certain percentage of that fund to us every year from our the accounts. So it will not impact our annual operating budget. Does this make sense? It will reduce what goes into the overall account we draw from over the years. So there will be a net reduction in the savings account, is kind of what I call it, that lives out there where all the revenue streams that have been established by the legislature to fund our work go. And it just means the amount we take every year isn't changing, though.
Okay. Unless Senator Meyer
changed through our budget.
Yeah, if I may, I may be thinking more on the commercial side of things here, but typically on oil spills, the cost, whoever caused the cost is the one that should be paying the cost. And in this case, the homeowner, like Senator Wolakowski said, it could be a $500,000 home or it could be a $100,000 home. We want them to be responsible homeowners and take care of their heating oil tanks and et cetera. So I'm just wondering if we're maybe taking some of that responsibility of being a homeowner away from them by offering this program.
Senator Meyer, through the chair, I wouldn't agree with that. I feel that that homeowners are usually caught off guard when this occurs. It's out of their control. The release wasn't something, if it's an underground storage tank, they may not have ever even been aware of it. I feel like they're still taking the bulk of the burden on by cleaning up the spill. This is a pretty minimal give to just say we won't recover our costs to help them figure out how to do it. We're still expecting them to take on the bulk of the responsibility and costs associated with cleaning up the spill, and that's a big consequence when you're a homeowner versus a corporation that perhaps is got insurance policies and is prepared to do that work in case it occurs.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Meyer?
Yeah, if I may. So did you say the typical sometimes it can cost up to $5 or $6 to the homeowner to clean up the spill?
Senator, through the chair, the lowest I've seen is $6,000 for the cleanup, and it can get up to over $80,000. So it can be a substantial burden financially for a private homeowner.
Follow-up, Senator Meyer.
So it can be up to $80,000. And so I guess in that case, you would share the responsibility with the homeowner? So.
Senator, through the chair, this bill would only say they still have to pay all of that. What this bill would do is say I don't have to ask them to reimburse me for our time just helping them figure that out. Oh. So, while the $80,000 fee is probably what it cost them to clean it up, mine would have been, I don't know, $4,000, $2,000 of our time helping them respond. Several years ago, the legislature passed legislation adding a tax to refined fuels that many of you are a part of. I feel that at this point they are now contributing when they purchase that fuel to pay our costs. That is now feeding this account that feeds our budget, that pays for our daily operating costs. So they've paid upstream, is one term, for our expenses to provide them technical assistance already. And then when we call them or they call us with a problem, we turn around and bill them again. So it's just one way to think of it. I know that impacts all industry as well that pay into it, but we feel that the small homeowners are unduly burdened with a financial hit that they were unprepared for.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an interesting topic because I wonder how far you could actually take this. I mean, septic tanks and water wells, you know, if they get contaminated or whatever happens and the homeowner can't afford to take care of it or clean it up, is, you know, do we come in and offer help to them as well? I guess I'm just a little concerned. Whenever you start a new program, you start a new contingency or new constituency, it's difficult to it tends to grow, I guess, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And now, do you garnish PFDs at times if people can't pay?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, no, we do not garnish. And I would add that for septic system failures and drinking water systems, I've had a little familiar with them, the department doesn't bill for providing technical assistance for those activities now. Cost recovery is only in the spill prevention and response division. All other divisions in the department do not bill for providing technical assistance to anybody. A restaurant doesn't call and get a bill. I mean, they pay a permit fee, but they don't, every time they call for a question, they don't get a bill for that. So this is an unusual anomaly in the Department of Environmental Conservation that we recover, we're required to recover all costs of our providing assistance. So I just want to make that point on the record.
Okay, thank you.
Good point. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I want to go back here about 10 minutes ago. So the 60 releases, homeowners, is that annually?
Correct.
How many of those releases were caused by the fuel carrier?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I'm not aware of that, but that is a potential scenario that, you know, they're the ones handling the fuel, but I can't tell you specifically how many of those were caused by. And I would caveat this with saying that that's what we know about. That's what was reported to us. Right. We anticipate that as quite a 30% probably more that we don't know about.
Right. Follow-up, Senator Bishop.
The genesis of the bill is to, you're trying to encourage more reporting.
Yeah.
So you can use your mitigation expertise with the homeowner to properly clean up the soil.
Yes, Senator Bishop, through the chair. I will give you credit for asking us to focus more on prevention when we talked about the refined fuel tax bill several years ago. To prevent more spills, and this is one thing we think would help us at least mitigate the effects of when spills occur for these homeowners. We would like to adopt standards for home heating oil tanks, how you should have them sit. We have found that task harder than I anticipated because of the variation in our climates and our communities. What is a standard that could probably be achieved in Anchorage most likely could not be achieved in Queetluck. So how to provide some flexibility but some guidance on how home heating oil tanks should be set up to prevent spills has been a harder nut to crack than we thought. But we still would like to, I'm still pushing to eventually adopt some siting standards for home heating oil tanks so that banks can use that when they, for inspections, for home inspections. Right now you can get a home inspection for your drinking water system, for your wastewater system, but there is no equivalent in the heating oil tank world because there are no standards. So hoping at some point to achieve that so that more problems are caught earlier during the sales of homes with home inspectors, but progress.
Senator Von Imhoff, you had another question.
Yes, and thank you. If you've answered this, I apologize, but if a homeowner calls you and they explain that they have this big leak and then you offer them expertise on how to fix it and then they realize, oh, that's way too costly, I'm not going to do it, and they said, okay, see you later, bye, we're just going to leave it, do you end it there, or is there like a follow-up? Do you have an obligation to report them to some authority or like send in the hazmat troops, or are you just now, you have to carry this knowledge with you that there is an you know, unaddressed leak somewhere because they can't fix it?
Senator von Eimanoff, through the chair, it varies a lot. Every situation is different. If there's a serious or imminent threat to the environment, we are obligated by statute to fix it. We try to force the responsible party to do that. If they cannot, for whatever reason, we will step in to do it if there's a serious or imminent threat to the environment. And we utilize our response account, which is separate from our account, our prevention account that we use for our operating budget, to do so. That said, we don't do that very often. We use all of our powers to get the homeowner or whomever to at least stop the release and minimize the impacts to the environment. That's why we like this legislation, because we try to do, and we'll take the person to Walmart and help them buy absorbent pads so they can go out and mop it. I mean, sometimes it takes hand-holding to get people to understand what they need to do to fix their problem. And we try to do everything we can to help them fix their problem. But the obligation is on them legally to resolve it. If they refuse, yes, we can step in and we can do it ourselves, but that comes with a cost. You know, our obligation is to recover our costs. So we would pursue them for cost recovery if we think they had resources. We put liens on people's property. If they don't have the money now, but once they sell their property, it will be an asset. We have various tools we use to get the environment in a manner that it should have been in.
Director Ryan, I have a question about the fiscal note. So it's a loss, a negative of $60,000. There is another bill in another committee that is proposing to raise the fees on industrial spills. And that fiscal note, I believe, is proposing to raise another $75,000. Is it coincidental that would fill this gap, or?
Madam Chairman, yes, it's coincidental. Right. And the other bill isn't fees, it's in penalty. It's penalties for spills.
Okay.
So it's different than cost recovery. It's a penalty for noncompliance.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yeah.
We do have one invited testimony person available. Fabian Peter Contese is here. Fabian, if you'd come forward and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Resources Committee. Thanks for having me. For the record, my name is Fabian Peter Contese. While I work for the state of Alaska, I'm here today on as a private citizen, a 36-year resident of Juneau, and I'm on personal time. I absolutely support this bill, SB 158, which would allow DEC to waive the cost recovery for small oil spills in residential units. We had an underground oil tank leak at our home in Juneau. And when we discovered it, we immediately called DEC, and we had Scott Tiernan come out and help us and guide us and give us the information we needed to move forward immediately. So the next day we had a contractor out who cut the tank open, or dug it out, cut it open, filled it with concrete, and cleaned up anything that was left in the tank. And then we started cleanup on our property, which was significant. We've spent tens of thousands of dollars on this effort, on the cleanup itself. We've spent additional several thousand dollars on soil testing on our property. And none of these expenditures are covered by homeowners insurance, so these are all out of pocket. In 2017, we started to receive bills from DEC for reviewing our case. And each time we responded to an inquiry from DEC or asked for clarity on any guidance we were given, we received a bill for that contact. And I understand the state's fiscal crisis. I understand the need that we have to increase revenues where we can, to fill the gaps, to recover costs. But the current statute discourages homeowners from reaching out. To Senator Wilkowski's point about needs-based, I'm in a very, very fortunate situation where I can afford to spend thousands of dollars. Unfortunately, I don't want to, but I can afford to clean up this oil spill. But what it did was it turned me off to reaching out to DEC to get the guidance I needed to work collaboratively with him. To Senator Meyer's comment, it didn't remove any responsibility from me, but it did shut me down from DEC to go, hey, I need your help. What do I do next? So we're still taking full responsibility for it. We still want to work with DEC. But if we get a bill for every time they look at our case, it basically shut us down. So this statute or this change, this bill is going to, this is going to be a good thing for homeowners, and especially those who can't afford to do, you know, first of all, you've got a big burden of cleaning up your oil spill, and then on top of it, you get a bill from DEC. And as the director of SPAR testified, it is an insignificant amount in their budget. The other piece that she mentioned, which I'd also like to point out, is that we already pay a surcharge on our heating fuel that helps fund this program. I really believe in what DEC does. The people that we've had contact with have been top-notch. They've given us good advice. They've worked with us. We check in with them. They check in with us. We have guidelines that we have to follow. Our goal as homeowners is the same as theirs, to make sure that the environment is cleaned up and there's nothing, you know, the spill is cleaned up. So I would very much encourage you to support this bill, to pass this bill. And thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Stedman has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just curious how many gallons you estimated your seepage or spill was out of your fuel tank.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, we had a 1,200-gallon underground oil tank that was, I don't know how many years old. We bought the house, and it was built in 81, so, you know. So it was a good number of years old. We don't know how many oil, how many gallons spilled. We have an estimate of several hundred gallons, but we weren't able to identify because we didn't know how long it had it been leaking, and our property is large and steep, so it was moving down our property.
Further questions, Senator Wilikowski.
Just a comment. I appreciate your testimony, and I guess I didn't realize that they were charging for making calls. That doesn't seem right to me, for homeowners to get charged for making a call to DEC to ask questions. So, and it comes to the term response costs on page 2, lines 2, and getting to DEC on how they define that. I guess in my mind, they were coming out there and actually doing the cleanup, and response costs, if that involves like phone calls and letters, that strikes me as being wrong to charge for that.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, they did come out to the house. They advised us on, so for instance, when we were doing the cleanup, which was basically slogging through our property with oil boom, absorbent boom, and pads, collecting free product, which with cups and pouring it into containers, and it's a lot of fun. And then also advising us, came out to the house and advised us on where to dig test holes after we had eliminated all free product. So they did come out to the house, but they weren't doing the cleanup. They were doing the advising. And yes, when we called or when we sent emails, we would get bills for that. But that wasn't the individuals, you know, that was the statute. That is the statute. It wasn't the individuals deciding to do that. And I know I've talked to several of their staff who, as the director had stated, they're extremely frustrated with that too, because it really puts up a barrier between the public and them, and they're trying to do the same thing we're trying to do.
Any further questions for Fabian? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thanks for having me.
I don't see anyone else online wishing to test. Oh, pardon me. I will open public testimony now. That was the end of the invited testimony. Is there anyone online? Seeing no one, is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. So at this time, we will set the bill aside. Thank you for being here, Director Ryan, and for Fabian, for your testimony. So this concludes our meeting. Our next meeting will be on Monday, February 5th. The committee will have an overview of the Department of Natural Resources Parks Division with the new Parks Director. So we will adjourn at this time. Let the record reflect. The time is 5:05 p.m.